Hello, this is On Science, the weekly science podcast from National Public Radio Science Desk. I'm Chris Joyce, and this week we're going to hear some stories about the West Antarctic ice sheet. There's some new research that's rather surprising. We're going to hear a story about new climate legislation in Congress that's working its way through the House of Representatives. And we're going to hear about a 35,000-year-old piece of art.
The most striking feature of this is its virtually pornographic nature.
Plus ça change, plus la même chose. But first, we're going to hear about the West Antarctic ice sheet. I've had to say that three or four times now just to get it right. You've probably heard quite a bit about it if you've been paying attention to climate stories over the last few years. It's this enormous body of ice at the South Pole, which is vulnerable to climate change. And scientists have been predicting that if it indeed gets warm enough, the air or the ocean that's underneath or next to the ice sheet, that the ice sheet could collapse, which would put a whole bunch of mass into the ocean and raise sea levels drastically to the point where coastal cities could be inundated and not only lives lost, but a tremendous amount of agricultural land lost. I mean, basically a catastrophe. But we're going to hear from Richard Harris, NPR science correspondent, about some new research that suggests that maybe some of our numbers have been wrong on this. So let's hear what Richard has to say.
Scientists have been worried about the West Antarctic ice sheet for decades because a lot of it is resting on ground below sea level. If warm ocean water gets under it, the ice could start flowing off the continent and into the sea. And that ice, and ultimately water, would increase sea levels by a lot. How much? Well, a landmark research paper published 30 years ago concluded that the vulnerable ice sheet contains enough water to raise global sea level by 20 feet.
The strange thing about that study is that nobody's reevaluated the number since then.
Enter Jonathan Bamber from the University of Bristol in the UK. He and his colleagues realize that there's a lot more information about Antarctica's geology today, which could help them refine how much of that ice sheet is actually vulnerable to a runaway collapse. Using radar and gravity data, they have a much better idea of the shape of the ice cap and the shape of the rock below.
And what we found was that it's not the whole of West Antarctica, it's about 70% of the area that would actually melt away into the ocean, according to this hypothesis.
So Bamber's group now concludes in Science magazine that if West Antarctica does collapse catastrophically, global sea level will eventually rise by about 11 feet, not 20. And here's something odd. Sea level doesn't go up the same everywhere. That's because the West Antarctic ice sheet weighs a lot, and that mass creates a gravitational pull that currently piles up ocean water in the Southern Ocean. If the ice sheet melts, the Earth's gravity field will shift and water will flow north. So Bamberg says sea level will rise more on some coastlines, less on others.
Global sea level rise is 11 feet, but in some places it's about 25% more than that. And unfortunately, it looks like the Pacific and Atlantic seaboards of North America, at least, are areas where the relative change in sea level is going to be greater.
So in the long run, United States shorelines could retreat more than other coastlines elsewhere on the planet. But that's the long run. How much of that could show up in the coming decades?
That is the $64 million question.
And Bamber has no answer. Neither does any other glaciologist, including Robert Binshadler at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. But what Binshadler does say is he doesn't want the new research on the long-term fate of the ice sheet to distract people from the more immediate worries.
Because it really doesn't change the big picture. Decision makers, the public, they have to worry about this century, or maybe if they're really visionary, next century. And this paper doesn't change that picture one iota.
If the West Antarctic ice sheet does collapse, it's likely to take hundreds and hundreds of years. And Binshadler says the global changes in gravity, which could redistribute ocean water around the world, could take even longer.
Those won't come into play for many centuries, if not millennia, down the road.
And even then, Binshadler can think of scenarios in which the West Antarctic ice sheet could still melt away entirely and still raise global sea level by 20 feet. 20 feet, 11 feet. Jonathan Bamber agrees that in either case, we can't breathe easy.
17 million people in Bangladesh alone would be displaced for about a 4 feet sea level rise. So, yeah, I mean, 11 feet is just unthinkable.
And there are signs that we could be heading gradually in that direction. Two large streams of ice that flow from the Antarctic continent into the ocean have been speeding up for the past few years, and scientists are wondering if this could be the first signs of an ice sheet collapse. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Hey, Chris, it's Rebecca.
Hello, Rebecca Davis. Joining us this time for the podcast. You've been here all along, but Rebecca very rarely speaks.
I just couldn't hold back.
Rebecca speaks.
I speak.
What did you think of that story?
Well, I actually thought it was really interesting. I've been frustrated, in fact, when I first heard when we were discussing the story earlier this week in the meeting, and I just thought, I mean, this reminds me of nutritional studies where 1 year you're told, you know, absolutely don't eat butter, eat margarine, and then the next you're told, absolutely don't eat margarine, eat butter. And climate science seems a little bit like that to me. It's sort of frustrating.
All science.
Okay. No,
because,
all right.
You know, scientists will sometimes tell you that science is like, it is linear, but it's linear the way spaghetti is. Because it snakes forward and it seems to be making forward progress, but oops, all of a sudden something comes up that sort of smashes previous opinions and hypotheses, and it takes a backward turn. But then, you know,
you're
eventually
cooking your spaghetti too much, Chris.
Well, when I throw it against the wall, I know it's done.
Okay.
But you know, it does. It's not actually quite linear. It does circle back on itself. But eventually, you know, we know more than we knew a year or two, five, seven, eight, 10 years ago.
But, which adds up to what in this case?
Well, in this case, you know, I think as a scientist made clear at the end, if it's not 20 feet, it's 10 feet. You know, to use a scientific term, the sign is the same. The direction is the same. Things are getting bad. You know, if the sea level rises only 10 feet and not 20, assuming that the Antarctic ice sheet does collapse, which is an assumption, you know, that's still pretty bad. It's a disaster. It's a catastrophe.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good. Well, I wonder about, we're in Washington, so, you know, and you cover what's happening on Capitol Hill with the climate bill. And there was a time when, under a different administration, perhaps, a study that would come out like this that would challenge a long-held notion about something mm-hmm. like...
About the severity of climate change.
Severity of yeah. it, absolutely, would have had... might have had a profound political impact. What's going on? Will this affect what's happening in Capitol Hill right now?
Yeah, well, the train's out of the station, frankly. I think, you know, there is a climate bill, which we will talk about and hear about in a few minutes, that's in the House of Representatives. But, you know, there's enough momentum that, as I say, this is interesting for science, but I think politically things are on their way. Now, whether this bill will pass is a whole different story, but then, well, why don't we just hear the story that I did?
Right, you did a story.
Yes, did
You're
a
always
story.
Trying to get on air. Uh-huh. Perfect.
Well, I get paid to do this.
Too much, in my opinion, but let's hear the story.
All right, bye. If this bill passes, businesses will have to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases they emit in this new energy world, and they've sent people like Kara Saul Rinaldi to Capitol Hill to find out just how much the new legislation is going to affect them. Rinaldi works for the consulting firm Environmental Resources Management. She tells her clients that this year they should expect real change.
In the past Congresses, there was a Republican in the White House who had made it clear that he would veto legislation like this. The current president has asked for legislation like this. So it's there's a real difference in just the political environment.
The operative phrase for the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009 is heavy lifting. That certainly applies to the draft of the bill written by California Democrat Henry Waxman, which was more than 600 pages, and to the enormity of the goal, moving away from fossil fuels like coal and oil that produce climate-warming greenhouse gases. And Rinaldi's view is that many business executives who once fought the idea of limiting emissions now realize they'll have to shape the legislation.
I think most companies these days recognize that the writing's on the wall and they will need to pay for their carbon at some point. It would be easier if you didn't have to pay for it at all, or if it was cheap, or if you didn't have to do it anytime soon. But at the same time, if you're going to have to pay for it, you need to know when and what and how much.
But business lobbyists have softened the bill. The Edison Electric Institute, which represents utilities, already helped convince legislators to lower the bill's target for greenhouse gas reductions. Emissions must be 17% below what they were in 2005, but not until 2020. Dan Riedinger is the spokesman for the Institute.
That's certainly an improvement over a 20% reduction, which was initially required under the earlier draft, but it's still pretty aggressive, and there's some concern that coal-fired power plants might have to shut down prematurely, some of them, and switch to natural gas. Natural gas is cleaner than coal, but it ends up being more expensive.
The current bill also requires utilities to eventually make part of their electricity from renewable sources like wind and solar power. The Institute says that's expensive, too, and wants to lower that percentage. Members of the Energy and Commerce Committee from both parties say many of the bill's provisions will cost Americans too much money, and Republican members say they'll come up with their own version next week. Environmental advocate David Hamilton of the Sierra Club says, though, that this is the best chance yet to get a climate bill through Congress and signed into law.
This is one of the great legislative expeditions in history, and they're pretty well outfitted.
But, he says, it still gives industry too much. Over a decade, for example, to figure out how to remove polluting carbon dioxide from coal. He says another provision that allows companies to pay for carbon-cutting projects in foreign countries before cutting their own emissions needs better policing. And contrary to what the White House wants, industry won't have to pay the government for permits to emit greenhouse gases, at least not yet. Representative Waxman says he's confident his committee will finish work on the bill by Memorial Day.
So, Chris, I just want to ask you something real quick. I mean, maybe we're all a little cynical at this point, but the fact is that so often, particularly with climate and energy bills, you know, it's just death by a thousand cuts. You've got people with different agendas. It doesn't break down Republican, Democrat. You've got, you know, people over here with protecting their own little constituency.
Mm-hmm. Coal industry, for example.
Huge,
oil industry,
right. How are they going to marry all of these various interests? I mean, somebody at some point, it's like watching my twins fight. It's like at some point somebody's got to say, oh, I don't care. You take it. That's perfectly fine.
or somebody finally says, stop already. I'm going to take over and just make this happen.
Right. You just come in with a big boot. Yeah.
Well, that's what they're hoping President Obama will do. Because in the past, these things have been chipped away. Everybody's, you know, somebody from a coal state says, well, okay, let's make a loophole for coal companies. And somebody else says, well, you know, we come from a big hydro area. We need more money for hydro because it's a clean energy source, you know, or I have a lot of people in an urban area and they depend, a lot of poor people, and they can't afford to pay more on their utility bills. And this is going to raise utility bills. And so we can't, you know, on and on. And it's going to take somebody really in charge, somebody big, somebody with clout, and that would be the president. And as you mentioned, the previous president had always told Congress, if you pass a climate bill, I'm going to veto it. So that's not much of an incentive to really do the heavy lifting that's required.
But what do you mean if somebody's in charge because that's his role? He can veto the bill or he can sign it?
Well, he's in charge, but he gave them the message that, you know, you can work yourself 24 hours a day trying to figure out how to please everybody and come up with something that's not completely diluted rather than diluted.
Yeah.
And I'm going to veto it anyway. So that hardly is much of an incentive. But what President Obama has said is, I want a climate bill. I want it. I want it soon. It's got to have muscle. It's got to do something about what's happening with climate change. And I will sign it if you'll get it together. And that has galvanized people to a certain extent. Now,
has it brought together any interesting politics makes strange bedfellows? Yeah. Are we seeing interesting alignments?
I think that that's to come. It has, interestingly, galvanized the Republicans altogether to oppose it. But it's also split the Democrats because there are many Democrats who are, as I said, worried about their energy interests in mm-hmm. their own states. And so the Democrats have to be brought together. And it seems as if that's happened. But let's hear the story and we'll find out more.
Didn't we just hear it?
Oh, we did.
We could hear it again.
Sorry.
Do you want to hear it again?
Stop already. Move on.
Okay, if you really want to hear that story again, just rewind and play it again. Play. And if not, we're going to go on to something else. You did this very racy little interview this week. I was a little appalled when I first heard it because I thought you were being awfully sexist. But I have to tell you, I cut out the super sexist part and just left in Chris at his best.
Well, the scientist did say that this research is going to annoy feminists. So I guess he identified the first one who heard it.
It was me, but I think it's his interpretation that might... Anyway, you can...
Well, Paul Mellars is an archaeologist who has... actually, he's not the discoverer. Other scientists in Europe were the first to discover this. It's an almost 3-inch tall carving of a woman with very exaggerated sexual features, and it dates back 35,000 years, and these scientists believe that it's probably certainly the oldest that they've ever seen before, a representation of a human and certainly of a woman, and they're quite intrigued by it. It is extremely old, and it does happen to have occurred during a period when there was an explosion of art in among Homo sapiens, and this was at a time when Neanderthals were also at large in the land. And
so we're talking how many years ago?
35,000 years ago. So this is a period in Europe when Homo sapiens, us, had recently come in from Africa and met up happily or otherwise with Neanderthals. And but there was beside the Neanderthal part, there was quite a blossoming there of, about this time of representational art, and there were cave paintings around the same period of animals, but there were very few, if any, cave paintings of humans.
That is interesting.
And suddenly they appeared right around this time, and this one, by carbon dating, is the oldest found so far.
Sort of a prehistoric renaissance.
Well, they're calling it a prehistoric pinup, but then we don't want to go there, do we? We'll let Professor Paul Mellars, an archaeologist from the University of Cambridge, talk a bit about what he thinks of it. He wrote about this in the journal Nature, where the discovery was published this week.
The most important aspect of the find is that it's the earliest representation known in the world of a woman. And that has to be extremely interesting and important to a lot of people.
Is it the earliest of a woman or of a human?
Certainly the earliest of a woman. Now, from another site, not too far away from that site, there is another representation carved out of ivory, like this new discovery, but much bigger. It's about 30 centimeters long, whereas the new find of a woman is only about 6 centimeters long. But the bigger piece from the nearby site of Herrlingstein Stadel is basically a carving of a man with a phallus, with a penis, but it's equipped with a lion's head. They found them in two separate pieces. They found the male human figure first, and then they found the lion's head, and then on a later, they realized that the two pieces stuck together. And that is, must be almost exactly the same age as this new discovery of a woman. So in that sense, we've got two roughly equal-aged representations of human figures, one of a woman and one of a man. But as I say, the male figure is what we call a therianthropic figure because it's only half human.
You can't help but notice that the Venuses, as well as this one, the sexual characteristics are exaggerated. What is that telling us about how people approached art when they first invented it?
Well, as you said, the most striking feature of this is it's virtually pornographic nature. There's a gross exaggeration of all the sexual features, the breasts, the abdomen, the buttocks, and the thighs, and the vulva, sex organ region, and all other aspects of the figure are played down. It's got only very attenuated legs. It's got very barely represented arms and hands, and it's got no head at all. Instead of the head, it's got what at first looks like a minuscule head, but that is actually part of the carving, and it's a ring, obviously, to allow the object to be suspended. And we assume that people wore it on their bodies somewhere.
There's a talisman.
Whether they hang it around their neck. I mean, we assume it was men who was generating this art, but of course that is, at the end of the day, that's pure speculation.
Right.
But it's the start of the whole world's tradition of representation of women, and often very sexually explicit representations of women. And of course that goes down right to our own day. And of course that's much more explicit, much more widespread in representing the female form. than the male form.
You could say that it's not strictly aimed at the female form because some of the earliest artwork also included exaggerated phalluses or, you know, disembodied phalluses.
That's very, very important that from about four other sites of the same period in Western and Central Europe, we do have explicit representations of phalluses, but as you say, they're disembodied phalluses. Whether they're exaggerated phalluses is another question. I mean, the biggest one we have is 25 centimeters, that is 10 inches long. As I said in my piece, one of my first-year students at Cambridge came up to me after a lecture when I'd shown a picture of this and said very hesitantly, do you think it's possible that these are girls' toys? And I immediately changed the conversation onto talking about the weather.
But it sounds as if it's quite possible.
I think that becomes a very, very serious possibility. And again, not surprising.
Yeah, well, I suppose...
I'm not sure anything about this discovery is terribly surprising. It's just, in a sense, what one might have anticipated. But it's nevertheless fascinating. The world's first representation of a woman has got to be fascinating and important.
I think it's important.
Well, I think it's fascinating.
Well, I guess it's fascinating and important.
Yeah, well, I like the part where on top it had a little ring on it, and apparently...
They think of it as an amulet.
The amulet was worn as an amulet.
There's something about discovery of things aesthetic that is far more exciting and inspiring, actually, than something that is than a tool. I'm sorry, tool people. Tools are cool. But, you know, this is where we start linking, I wouldn't say spiritually exactly, but we do start linking in a different way our own behavior and our own feelings and our own passions with our ancestors from tens of thousands of years ago. So I do find myself engaged in this, even though I gave you a really hard time about it.
Well, you're right. It's the way they put it is symbolic behavior or symbolic representation. When you're carving a tool, it's not symbolic of anything necessarily. It's a tool. It's something you use to get what you need.
Mm-hmm.
When you go into this realm of representing something else in the world, whether it's an animal carved on a wall or whether it's a woman who may represent, in this case, fertility, or it may simply be sexual. Nobody knows, and probably nobody will ever know. Sex and fertility go together anyway, but...
They do? We'll study that next week.
Well, you're the one who
podcast.
Had twins. But, and it also brings up an interesting conversation, I suppose, which we may not have at the moment, about a comment that he made, which is, you know, it borders on the pornographic. Well, what is pornography anyway?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. And as what did the Supreme Court say? Well, I don't know what it is, but I know when I see it.
Right, exactly.
Well, this is 35,000 years old, and, if you have a look at it, you may decide on yourself whether it's pornographic or not, but it certainly is an ancient piece of craftsmanship.
I love this. It's people... You know, it's Homo sapiens digging around for greater meaning. It's searching for something other than what you need to do to get you through the day. So that was very interesting, Chris. Thank you.
Well, we had climate, we had art, and now we have goodbye.
Goodbye.
And thanks for coming and listening to NPR's On Science podcast. We'll be back next week with yet another one. In the meantime, you can...
Write us
with ideas and thoughts at
nprscience@npr.org
and tell us what you'd like to hear or what you don't want to hear. Bye-bye now.